Sam Houston, a giant of a man, not only in physical stature, but in his defiant character, and of course, by his prominent place in history. In Houston's own words, "I am a Union man. The great champion of the Union was Andrew Jackson. To him descended from the fathers of the Republic, in a direct line, the principles upon which he stood, and his declaration, the Union, it must and shall be preserved, will never be forgotten. I have never in my life seen an Andrew Jackson Democrat who is not a firm and decided Union man." Sam Houston's ties to Andrew Jackson extend back to 1814 at the Battle of Horseshoe Bend in Alabama. Houston, just 21 years old, has risen in a short period of time from private to lieutenant. Colonel Andrew Jackson calls for volunteers to lead an assault on the formidable Creek breastworks. Houston, despite being wounded, steps forward. And lead he does. He is one of the first American soldiers over the top of the breastworks. He leaps into the midst of the Red Stick warriors and fights like a lion. He's wounded again, twice in the shoulder and in the arm. In the end, the militia prevails and wins a major victory. The effects of the wounds linger with Houston for the rest of his life. So does his relationship with Andrew Jackson. Their destinies intertwined. When Jackson is U.S. Senator from Tennessee in 1823, Houston serves as U.S. Congressman from the state. In 1827, Houston becomes governor of Tennessee. Andrew Jackson, in turn, becomes president of the United States in 1829. The two men are close, politically and personally. Sam Houston's meteoric career continues. He leaves Tennessee for Texas, where he leads the Texan army to victory at the Battle of San Jacinto, arguably one of the most decisive battles in world history. Houston becomes first president of the Republic of Texas. He leads Texas into the Union on December 29, 1845. He represents Texas as its first U.S. senator. To most Americans, Sam Houston is Texas. But by 1854, with a debate over slavery and talk of secession coming to a head, Houston tarnishes his star among his fellow Texans. Senator Houston speaks on the Senate floor on February 15, 1854, in opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which will remove the limitations of the Missouri Compromise on slavery in the Western Territories. A pragmatic man, Houston knows well that there will be serious consequences in the North with passage of this act. He says, "We are not acting alone for ourselves, but our trustees for the benefit of posterity. Our actions are to inure to them for good or evil. We are, by our legislation, to benefit or to prejudice them. Mr. President, in the far distant future, I think I perceive those who come after us who are to be affected by the action of this body upon this bill. Our children have two alternatives here presented. They're either to live in after times in the enjoyment of peace, of harmony, and prosperity, or the alternative remains for them of anarchy, discord, and civil broil. We can avert the last. I trust we shall. At any rate, so far as my efforts can avail, I will resist every attempt to infringe or repeal the Missouri Compromise." Only 2 months after President Buchanan signs the Kansas-Nebraska Act into law, a determined group of men in the North form the Republican Party in direct opposition to the act and the expansion of slavery. Within 6 years, the Republicans emerge as a major political force in the North. The election of its candidate, Abraham Lincoln, to president causes 11 Southern states to secede from the Union and lead to civil war. Meanwhile, in the short term, the Kansas-Nebraska Act sets off so much violence, Kansas Territory becomes known as Bleeding Kansas. Among the more prominent participants is the abolitionist John Brown. The Texas legislature, infuriated with Sam Houston for his opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, refuses to extend to him another term as senator, and Houston looks for another path to lead. As the nation slides closer and closer to war, Texas Democrats nominate states' rights advocate and secessionist Hardin Reynolds for governor of that state in May of 1857. Sam Houston declares his intention to oppose Reynolds as an independent candidate. Houston is 64 years old, and secession is counter to everything he believes in. In his words, "Whatever is calculated to weaken or impair the strength of the Union, whether originating in the North or the South, whether arising from the incendiary violence of abolitionists or from the coalition of nullifiers, will never meet with my unqualified approval. Houston has few equals as a stump speaker. He travels the state in a carriage, hundreds and hundreds of miles down dusty roads in 100-degree weather. The campaigners bitterly fought. Reynolds prevails in the 1857 gubernatorial election. It is the only election which Sam Houston, the living legend, ever loses. And it is a clear indication as to how emotionally charged Texans have become over slavery and secession. The old general remains defiant. In January 1859, he writes, "As a Union man, I have ever maintained my position, and I ever shall. I wish no prouder epitaph to mark the border slab that may lie on my tomb than this. He loved his country. He was a patriot. He was devoted to the Union. If it is for this I have suffered martyrdom, it is sufficient that I stand at quits with those who have wielded the sacrificial knife." Then comes the turning point. The old general writes his friend and fellow Unionist, George Pascoe, on June 3, 1859. "Yesterday I yielded to my own inclination of my friends and concluded, if elected, to serve the people as executive of the state. The Constitution of the Union embrace the principles by which I shall govern, if elected. They comprehend all the old Jackson national democracy I ever professed or practiced." Houston goes on the offensive against secession. He leaves no doubt where he stands on this divisive issue. He writes newspaper editor Ferdinand Flake on July 2nd, "There are isms of a most dangerous character which threaten our safety, as well as our existence, to which I am unalterably opposed. These are the isms of nullification, secession, and disunion, which are in vogue with many men who claim to be the friends of the South, but are in reality demagogues." At Nacogdoches, while on campaign on July 9th, Houston tells a crowd gathered, "I am a Democrat of the old school. In politics, I am an old fogey because I cling devoutly to those primitive principles upon which our government was founded and under which the Constitution went into operation. I have no modern improvements to make on the principles of our fathers." The hero of the Battle of San Jacinto and the first president of the Republic of Texas manages to win the August 1859 gubernatorial election in Texas on the sheer power of his persona and his legend, and with the help of voters on the frontier who would have voted for anyone other than Reynolds in the hope of some help against the rampaging Comanche. The election of a Unionist to governor gives some sense of hope to moderates that the people of Texas might yet find their way to justify avoiding secession. However, before Houston takes office in late December, events beyond his control change the political landscape throughout the South, including in Texas. In October 1859, John Brown, of Kansas infamy, leads a small band of men and captures the U.S. Army arsenal at Harper's Ferry in Virginia. His plan is to free the slaves, arm them, and lead revolt across the South. Brown believes he is the instrument of God's wrath. Southerners are certain that Brown is an instrument of the Republican Party. The federal government hangs John Brown on December 2, 1859. Southerners are outraged that the Northern press proclaims Brown a martyr instead of a fanatic and a murderer. So by the time General Sam actually takes office as governor of Texas on December 31, 1859, the momentum has dramatically shifted back to the planters calling for secession. Texans tar and feather and whip and even hang transplanted Yankees and traveling salesmen and preachers. Paramilitary groups form and begin drilling in anticipation of war. Houston does his best in his inaugural address to calm Texans. It's not his best speech. He knows the water's over the dam. "When thought becomes treason, the traitor is as much the enemy of one section as the other. Its overt acts we must repeal. The eternal din which has been echoed to their song of hostility to the South is music to their ears." How happy would have been the result if the attention of statesmen, North and South, had been as much directed towards promoting harmony between the states and cementing those fraternal bonds, which can alone hold us together as a people, as toward promoting the strife of sections and the antagonisms which are fast dividing us.